Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. I'm still Katie Givens. I'm not a lawyer.
Scott Wright, mediocre journalist.
Kelly Turner, not a doctor.
So did everybody notice when you sat down this morning that the toilet seat was a little bit colder than usual? It's mm-hmm. that time of year again. The weather is changing.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I had to get my little tiny space heater out and come back 10 minutes later so that it had time to work in the bathroom area.
My house is not yet cold on the inside. Mm-mm. I wouldn't say.
Mine is well, I fell asleep last night with the door wide open, mm-hmm. and the low last night was, I don't know, what, 48 degrees?
Oh, that's why your house was, yeah.
How do you
maybe
sleep?
I should have started with that part.
How do you sleep soundly and safely with your door wide open?
I don't know.
I can't sleep with the window open.
I didn't
open.
Mean to.
I can't sleep with a door open. I can't sleep with a window open. I check my locks, probably because we do a true crime podcast.
Yeah.
And it makes me a little bit paranoid.
Well, but see, normally it wouldn't be 10, 15 minutes before one of the cats jumps in, and that makes just enough noise mm-hmm. over the gate that keeps the dogs inside that I would hear it and it would wake me up because I'm asleep on the couch right beside that door. But last night, I just slept hard.
I could sleep with a window open. I think that's probably like my country upbringings where we didn't turn the AC on, but no, a door? That's crazy.
You're just there, vulnerable for.
Well, I can't do it anymore since you guys have made such a thing about it.
To walk in, you just made it easy.
I've got until the date this episode airs to enjoy my back door open, and then I can never do it again. Thanks, guys.
I'm never like really scared in my house, except when not even when I'm home alone, but when I know Shane's out of town. I'm like, what's he gonna do at Easy Street when I'm home alone if someone breaks in? But if he's just, you know, in town, I'm still not scared.
You still feel
like
safe.
I don't get like the hearing the noises. Second he leaves town, I'm like locking the garage door. Like Ellison came in the other day. She said, why is the garage door down? Because I don't ever put it down. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, your dad's not here. And she's like, she's thinking, I mean, you're always here by yourself. What are you talking about?
but he's not in town this time.
But no, I'm not going to put that in her head. So I just was like, yeah, you know, I don't know. I just put it down.
Yeah, I don't want to. Are you packing?
Well, we do have them in the house, yes. Mm-hmm. They're accessible. I should probably learn how to work them better. He's shown me over and over because I make that same comment and he's like, this is very easy. Let me show you again. Here mm-hmm. it is. Da 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 da. Mm-hmm. But I need to take it out and shoot it actually, probably to mm-hmm. feel comfortable actually shooting it. But it is mm-hmm. there right in the nightstand.
There. Yeah. There it is.
Well,
are you packing, Scott?
No comment.
Okay. All right.
I don't want to give it away. I've already told everybody I sleep with the door open.
Yeah.
Let's mm-hmm. make them wonder about the firearm in the house.
Okay.
You're allowed to. Kamala and Tim Walz both have them. So.
I'm just saying I want the potential perpetrator to be on his toes when he comes to my house. Mm-hmm. So
I don't think that's a thing anymore. Is that kind of like a dying trend?
Well, you know, that's just been the buzz, you know, the buzzwords recently in the... Kamala saying she has a Glock. That's like on TikTok.
I mean, I don't blame her.
No.
I have a SIG. I don't do a Glock, but I have a SIG.
I have a half a pack of SIGs
in my pocket. I also have the smaller one. Is that a 380?
Sure.
I got one of those.
Absolutely. That's
those
exactly
things
what
jump,
it is.
Though. When you shoot them, they mm-hmm. jump because the bullets in those are almost the same size as a 9mm. So you got to hold on to it tightly.
So no Clint Eastwood style, one handed from the hip type shooting experience for you? Okay.
Not if I want to accurately fire the weapon. Yeah. No.
Well, does it matter if you accurately fire it? I mean, just the noise alone is enough for most people to take off running, right?
I think the warning sign is the when you rack it.
Yeah.
When you put the book. That's people know what that sound means.
Yeah.
If I get to a point where I have to shoot a gun at someone, I'm not doing it to scare them because I would never just try to scare someone mm-hmm. off like that. Like,
No.
If you're to
I'm
that
not
point,
firing it if I don't feel threatened or like,
yeah,
I'm gotta, stopping a threat. Yeah.
Yeah. You got to put them down if you can.
I hope we never have to use these skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This took a turn this morning. Yeah.
It's a dark, it's a difficult world out there.
Let's start.
Most of the people there are nice and friendly, but for the ones that we talk about on this podcast, have a safety plan. Jeez.
So we discussed before we went on the air that there are no shout outs today. Is that correct?
No.
I feel like I have one, but I can't remember.
I'm sure someone told you something and you said you would shout them out and you forgot.
That sounds plausible.
Exactly.
If you're supposed to be shouted out in this episode, blame Scott.
Yes, please.
Re-remind him.
Yeah, tell me again. All right, are you guys ready?
Yeah.
Are we ready to do this?
Yeah, we're still
I hope you guys still like this episode when it's over because I had to kind of talk you into it.
Yeah.
And it's not really what you think of as a traditional true crime story.
No, but it's perfect for October.
But, right, I think you guys will be pleased when this is over with. So, if you're out there listening in true crime, crime land, you know what this podcast is about because you've read the title of the episode. Or maybe you don't because I thought I knew what this was about. I thought I knew this story a little bit going in. It turns out that I only remembered that the story existed in space and time.
Okay.
And I forgot everything else about it.
Okay.
Now, you guys are both in the dummy chair today, relatively speaking.
I'm very much in the dummy chair.
All right. Now, anyone of a certain age, my age or older, not that there's anything wrong with that.
Mm-hmm. We didn't say anything.
Remembers the old black and white TV show, The Twilight Zone. It started in 1959. So by the early 60s, it was a big deal. It was on TV all the time. One of the first shows that I remember sitting down and watching as a young child with my father. He was showing me how to work our little 13-inch black and white TV that we had down in the corner of the playroom. And we watched an episode of The Twilight Zone. And it was on syndication. This would have been the mid-70s. So it was already off the air, but it was on syndication at that time. And it is still today. You can watch it on Pluto TV, Amazon Prime, YouTube. If you've got the Sci-Fi channel on your channel package at home, you can watch the Sci-Fi channel and they have the old Twilight Zone episodes.
You are always advocating for some black and white television.
I know. We did favorite movies on that other podcast last week, and two of my three favorites were black and white films.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't listen to the episode, but I do know that you love a black and white movie.
So you don't listen to the other podcast.
Mm.
Good for you.
I listened to Shorty's episode.
Yeah, Shorty's, his is good. The rest of them.
I could make an exception for Shorty, that's for sure. But
yeah.
I do it in secret.
Shorty's was worth it. In secret. So we'll never even know if she does it. So the Twilight Zone.
I can tell y'all here.
Yeah, okay. Just after we finish recording. The Twilight Zone was the brainchild of Emmy award-winning writer Rod Serling. And he served as the host of the show, and he wrote more than half of the 150-plus episodes himself. Serling introduced the episode each week. He set the scene for that week's always weird-as-hell story. And almost always, you could count on it, twist ending.
So, who was better, this guy or Hitchcock? Because, you know, he did that, too.
I prefer the Twilight Zone. Alfred Hitchcock's show was, what was it called?
I don't know. He walked into his profile.
Yeah.
You know, and any.
Albert Hitchcock Presents, I think, was the name of the show.
Said he was creepy, yeah.
And there was Night Gallery. There was another show. There was a run on shows like this, just like anything else in Hollywood. If something is found to be successful, everyone else copies it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Hitchcock did. And I forget who was in charge of Night Gallery, but it was the similar show. They were happening on every network, but The Twilight Zone was the first and arguably the best.
So that's your favorite.
That was my favorite. Okay. You could count on this strange mix every week of humor, science fiction, drama, sometimes comedy, always superstition. Burt Reynolds, Roddy McDowall, and Robert Redford as young actors are just three of the faces that you will see on an old episode of The Twilight Zone.
Wow.
Yeah. You guys remember Burgess Meredith?
Yes.
He played the Penguin on the old 60s campy Batman series. And I think even Katie Beth Gibbons knows this one. He also played Mickey.
Mm-hmm.
In the Rocky films, he was the old boxing ring owner and trainer. He was nominated for an Academy Award for Mickey in Rocky in 76. He didn't win. And he died in 1997 at the age of 89, did Burgess Meredith.
He was in Grumpy Old Men.
That's
right. He played Jack Lemmon's dad.
He was Jack Lemmon's dad.
He was hilarious
Oh, my God. Grumpy Old Men is top 10
That's
funny
a great
movies
movie
of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so my favorite episode of the Twilight Zone show featured Burgess Meredith.
Okay.
He was in a couple, but this is the one that I remember. He was this mousy, absent-minded, bookish little bank teller, and he had the big, thick Coke bottle glasses. Henry was the character's name, but Henry, he wasn't a very good bank teller because what he really liked to do was sneak away from his job and read a book.
Oh.
And I can totally sympathize with that.
Yeah. I get that. Yeah.
We all can, right? Yep. So Henry wasn't a very good bank teller. He was absent-minded. It led to errors at the office. He eventually got reprimanded by his boss for being a reader instead of an effective worker. And his home life wasn't much better. Poor Henry, when he would go home at night, his wife would not let him read. She hid books from him and even tore apart a book that he had hidden to try and read when she went to bed.
I don't understand that. What's her problem?
I don't either.
Oh, that was just
you're wasting way. Your life away with those books. Oh. Remember, it's the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, what did she do every day? I want to know.
Not read. So Henry, one day he's taking his lunch break at the office at the bank, and he decides to sneak into the vault to do some reading where he will be alone. Lo and behold, there's a hydrogen bomb explosion outside, and he is the sole survivor on the entire planet. And so all that Henry has to do for the rest of his life is go to the library, collect books. He's found some canned food somewhere, and he's going to live the rest of his life reading and enjoying himself. He's the lone survivor of a nuclear holocaust. The title of the episode was Time Enough at Last.
I'll say.
Yeah.
And of course, there's an evil twist to fate at the end. Henry trips, breaking his glasses, and he cannot read. He is left collapsed on a heap of books. Fade to black.
Gosh.
I don't like that.
That's terrible.
It's my favorite episode of the Twilight Zone.
That's tragic. Do they all end that way?
Pretty much. Something horribly tragic.
And then they just leave you hanging.
It's the Twilight Zone.
That's weird.
Is this like the precursor to like Black Mirror?
Yes, absolutely. You could definitely point to Twilight Zone, the TV series, and say that is the father, the stepfather, twice removed of Black Mirror. Any show like that, Death, Love, and Robots on Netflix is a. It's an animated series, but it's 30, 40-minute episodes. Each one is a standalone episode. It's basically a different way of dropping somebody into the Twilight Zone, where nothing makes sense. The reality is contorted. Katie, I'm sorry. I keep interrupting
you. I was going to say, I don't think I would like how that episode would leave me feeling.
Yeah.
Like that.
I'm not
Then don't ever watch the Twilight Zone.
Okay, well, I'm not ever Black Mirror. Katie and Shane suggested that to me.
Yeah.
I watched the very first episode, and that was like several years ago, and I'm still not
Is that
over
the one
it.
With the pigs?
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Yeah,
the one with the British Prime Minister.
I'm still not over that.
And the pig.
Why is that your first episode?
We're still talking about it 10 years later.
Yeah, but I never watched another one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't bring myself to it.
I understand.
And from what I hear from Shane, that's not even the most disturbing one.
Oh, I'm sure.
It. That one will stick to you, but yeah, there are some ones that are not as not disturbing like that, but just as in a, this is what our world could be.
Were you talking about the one with Bryce Dallas Howard?
I don't know.
Where everybody has the phones? And you can vote on how much you like somebody.
That's one. That,
Community did a funny version of that.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm sure that's what it's a knockoff of. And that may be a knockoff of something else. But I know that one season, maybe the third season of that series, began with her and that episode. And it was pretty, it'll leave you thinking.
Yeah. I haven't watched them all because, yeah, it would just give you a pit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's disturbing, and that's what they're supposed to do.
That's right.
That's what they're designed
to
do.
Disturb you.
So that's good. I just don't prefer that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to watch, something slasher. Like, I don't like gore, but
I know.
But yeah. Like last night, my kids and I watched Scream again. I mean, it's our favorite.
Okay.
Halloween movie.
Well, that's a slasher, all right.
And it's great.
That one comes out hot.
Yeah, and I can enjoy that, and then like go to bed.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
But,
I know what you mean.
I can't watch something disturbing like that and then go to bed.
Well, all of these episodes of The Twilight Zone and Night Gallery and Black Mirror, they're all disturbing. They're all tragic tales.
Mm-hmm.
And today is another tragic tale. Strange as fiction, yes, but it's not fiction. Today we're going to tell you a story about a true crime that actually did take place in the summer of the year of 1982.
Okay.
So sit back, relax, close your eyes. Unless you're driving.
Yeah, don't. Please don't close your eyes.
And listen as Katie and Kelly and I tell you, as Rod Serling always announced at the beginning of every episode, we're going to take you on a journey of sound, a journey of sight, a journey of mind. There's a signpost up ahead. The next stop, the Twilight Zone. And now we don't have the music to go.
No, we don't have the rights to that. But I wish we did.
Can we just like a little 5-second clip? No, can't we just put that in post?
No, I'm not a lawyer, but no.
Whatever. All right, so speaking of 1982, instead of the usual set the table segment, which I know that both of you despise, Katie is already playing with her phone because she thinks that's the next segment and she hates this part.
Kevin Green loves it, though.
I know, Kevin. We thank you very much. Yeah. Please keep those positive thoughts coming in because you're the only thing saving the table set segment as far as I know. Okay, so 1982. I thought that we would do a little game here. We're going to revisit some of the bigger Hollywood blockbuster films from the year 1982.
Okay.
Because this story doesn't take place on the boob tube like we have been talking about with the Twilight Zone TV show. This is a story that's going to give us a rare look behind the scenes of what is required to convert a bit of imagination and a whole lot of money into what moviegoers see on the big screen. So ever since the TV version of the Twilight Zone had become popular in the 60s and continued to live on successfully in syndication, the big studios in Hollywood had been trying to figure out a way to transition that small screen success onto the silver screen. And it took nearly 20 years, but by the summer of 1982, production was underway on a film titled Twilight Zone, the movie. Now, I watched it again this past week. You can watch it for free on the Roku channel with ads, if you have it. The movie premiered in June of 1983, but our story takes place, don't forget, the previous year, in June of 82, when the production of the movie is taking place. That's when our story happens.
Got it.
Now, if you've seen the film before, but you don't know this story, go back and watch it again after you hear this today. You'll never watch the film the same way again.
I've not seen the film.
Okay.
I purposely didn't because I wanted to hear this and then go watch it.
I understood. I want a text from you tonight when you see it and tell me what you think.
Okay.
Katie, you're not going to watch it.
Katie, go watch Grumpy Old Man.
Yeah, do that first.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a bit of backstory that's necessary in order to explain the behind the scenes machinations, the goings on behind the scenes that took place in the boardrooms of these various movie studios and the directors and everybody else involved, that all these conversations that are required to take place in order for this transition from the small screen to the big screen to happen. And some of the names that we're going to speak in the next few minutes, now it depends on which side of the story you believe because there are multiple sides to this story, but some of the names that you're going to hear could possibly help to explain what eventually resulted in all of you out there listening right now and us sitting here telling you the story of this tragic true crime. Mm-hmm. One of the people involved in the production of Twilight Zone, the movie, was a man that you might have heard of. His name is Steven Spielberg.
Heard of him?
He was one of four directors that was involved in creating four separate standalone 25-minute segments that were going to be combined into Twilight Zone, the movie. So it's going to be like four separate episodes of the TV show jammed together with a common beginning and ending that you can understand if you watch it that tie the whole thing together.
Okay.
Now, of course, Spielberg was asked to take part in this venture because he was the most successful director in Hollywood at the time. He was only 35 years old in 1982, but already Spielberg had broken every box office record that had ever existed in 1975 when Jaws came out. And then he followed that with the blockbuster success of Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 1977, Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981, and he was in the process of breaking every existing box office record again in 1982 with E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Yeah. You guys seen E.T. the Extraterrestrial?
Oh yeah.
I have seen E.T.
All right. Keep a running total of that. the other three directors involved in the project were a man named Joe Dante, a man named George Miller, and a man named George Landis. Those were the other three young, upcoming directors. Now, if you're a movie buff like me, some of those names sound familiar, and it doesn't matter. We're not going to throw too many names at you today, but we need to mention those three that go along with Spielberg. The three of them were lesser known than Spielberg, obviously, but the intent on the production of Twilight Zone, the movie, was to become the brand new biggest movie of all time. All of these four directors had shown the ability to bring people in through the box office, put on a production that people found entertaining. And so you've got a big movie with a big budget and four big name directors, each doing his own segment with different plots, different characters. They're out on their own shooting their own segment. They'll be put together later. It was going to be extravagant, brand new, never before seen, pow in your face. This formula for a film could not possibly fail, right?
Well, I guess it did, though, since we're talking about it here, right?
Joe Dante got invited because he had taken, he had two previous low-budget horror films that had been big hits. One was Piranha in 1978. I remember watching that on the ABC Sunday Night Movie of the Week once. And The Howling from 1981, which I've never seen.
I've heard of it.
Okay. Joe Dante would go on to later direct Gremlins in 1984.
That's a good one.
And its sequel in 1990.
Magua.
Yeah. Yeah, don't feed him after midnight. Australian director George Miller got the call to direct one of the segments because of the success of Mad Max in 1979 and Mad Max 2 in 81, both of which starred young up-and-comer Mel Gibson. Miller would go on to find more success later on. This was 85. He did Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, again with Mel Gibson, and also with Tina Turner.
All those legs.
Yes, all those legs. The final young whippersnapper director was John Landis. And he's the
George
guy.
George or John?
John.
John
Landis.
Okay.
Not George Lucas. John Landis.
George Miller and John Landis.
That's
got
right.
it. Sorry.
John Miller is the major focus of the story today. And he got invited to take part in the Twilight Zone project because he had successfully directed National Lampoon's Animal House in 1978 and The Blues Brothers.
Oh, okay.
In 1980.
This is a different genre.
Yes. Even though Blues Brothers had been a financial failure for the studio, it was still a big, extravagant film with a bunch of stunts, which Landis was becoming known for. And it was also known that Landis liked to use, in some of his stunts sometimes, a helicopter.
Okay.
Stick a pin in that.
Got it.
Okay.
Well, also, that's a cult classic now, Blues
sure.
Brothers.
Yeah, it's became much more successful in VHS rentals and DVD, and mm-hmm. it has longer legs since, but it wasn't a very successful film at the box office.
I think when the two actors became more and more famous.
Yeah, that had a lot to do with it. And Dan Aykroyd and John Landis had a relationship for dozens of years. They corroborated on a lot of things through the years. In fact, you'll see a Dan Aykroyd cameo tonight when you watch Twilight Zone the movie.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
So I know that I give, especially Katie Beth, a hard time about the movies that she has never seen. Now, keep in mind out there in true crime land that I am 24 years older than Katie, and I've had a lot more time to watch movies than she has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
this movie you're talking about came out 10 years before I was born.
Exactly.
And she's also, and she's also in law school, so it's really hard to find time to.
Look, she hasn't been in law school her whole life. She had plenty of time before she started law school to get caught up on her movie watching. That's her responsibility.
But I probably could, you know, get through this list if I've didn't have a midterm this week.
Fair enough.
Definitely.
All right. Never mind. I'm still going to do this. I've already written this down, so I'm doing it anyway.
Go ahead. Okay.
All right. So I'm going to rattle off a few of the biggest films from 1982, and I want you guys to keep score on your fingers, and we'll see how this turns out, okay? Right. Now, number one, of course, was Steven Spielberg's E.T., which I saw once at the theater, and I've never seen again.
What?
I know. It's not because I didn't like it. It's just I got enough the one time, and I don't want to see it again.
That's insane.
Mm-hmm. I know. All right, I'm going to rattle off six more. We won't count that one. I'm going to do six more big-time films from 82. And you guys count on your fingers. Now, this is not a contest. There's no prize. I'm just curious.
Okay.
Another of the top grossing films of 1982, starring Dustin Hoffman, Tootsie. Rocky III starred Mr. T as Clubber Lang. All right, another big movie that year was Porky's, and I don't think either of the two of you have ever seen that. Shit, never mind. Kelly has seen Porky's. What about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan? Nobody on that one. That's kind of what I thought I was going to get there. Poltergeist was a horror film from that year that Steven Spielberg wrote and produced but did not direct. And finally, one of my favorite films of the year, it made a star out of both Richard Gere and Louis Gossett Jr., an officer and a gentleman. Ha! Five! How about that? So, Kelly has seen five, Katie has seen exactly zero, and I'm lying, there was a prize. I have Skittles.
Oh my gosh! This is
for
a
first
huge
prize.
Bag of Skittles.
He's just pulled this out of his jacket pocket.
I had to make a special trip, so make sure you don't lose those.
Large bag of Skittles.
King size. Yeah, I paid extra for that.
Love that. Thanks.
I feel like I owe you for something.
I'm going to eat some now.
For maybe babysitting
right
me.
Right in the microphone.
Last Wednesday. All right. Despite both of your silver screen shortcomings, and I'm counting this both as a shortcoming because that's the way I wrote it, because you got more than I thought, and you got exactly, Katie, how many I thought you would get, which was zero.
Yeah.
But I mean, to me, those movies, all of those movies that I rattled off, those are big hits to my buddies. We grew up watching those in the 80s and on VHS in the 90s. We sit around and quote those movies all the time, probably too often.
I've heard of them all.
Yeah. Right, well, that's something.
I'm sure the Star Trek has probably been on in my house because Shane periodically just goes back and watches everything Star Trek related.
That's the one with Ricardo Montalban.
I don't know.
Khan!
I am just not a Star Trek fan at all.
I can watch the movies.
I'm sorry. Please don't come for me. I know it's got a huge following.
The movies are fun.
I don't like the shows or the movies.
No, see, and I have, well, I won't say recently, but I'm a big fan of like romanticy books, like that are like world building fantasy situation.
Okay.
And I like when I read a book, I like to just fully immerse, and then I will talk about that book like it's real life. And I'll have friends who read it, and I'll, you know, we'll talk about the characters like they're real people. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to do that with Shane. I was trying to tell him about this book, and we were in the car one day going somewhere, and he was like, "You're telling me you don't like Star Trek, but you are talking about a Dragon War College." And I'm like,
"Oh my gosh, that's fourth wing."
Yeah.
And I'm like, talk anytime you want.
Yeah. I was like, "Yes." And he said, he was just like, "You would love Star Trek." And I was I've tried.
I don't love it either. And I love those books. Mm-hmm.
It's light on the romance on Star Trek. I mean, that's
and the spice. There's a lot of spice.
Yeah. This is just shoot 'em up and space tech.
This is just like, nerd
time
wars.
Travel. Yeah, it's nerd stuff.
And I kind of speed read through like battle scenes and stuff. And like I'm just like, I'll figure out who wins.
Get to the spice.
Yeah, they stab each other 10 times. The 11th one from this guy was the fatal one. Moving along.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I get it.
Yep.
All right, so I mentioned all of these Hollywood movies, this hype from the box office returns from 1982 to try and put your minds with the studio executives, what their minds were thinking. I knew I was going to get there eventually. Thanks for hanging on. Because these executives and these young directors and these film technicians and actors and everyone else involved in the film industry at the time is looking to produce the next bigger and better thing. That's always been the case with Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And it certainly was then, especially after Jaws and E.T. and Raiders and all those huge films. It seemed like all you had to do was put Steven Spielberg's name in the credits somewhere and it was a guaranteed success. Except for 1941, but that's another story for another time. So we know that these four directors had caught lightning in a bottle before. That's why they were asked to come back and do Twilight Zone, the movies. The movie was to try and duplicate that success. And so now it's time to focus specifically on the production of Twilight Zone, the movie, in the summer of 1982, and even more specifically, to the production of the segment of the film that was written and directed by John Landis of Animal House and the Blues Brothers. He's going to be our focus today. Now, depending on whose account of the story you read, there was a huge, if largely unspoken, competition that always was going on between Landis and Spielberg. They were friends at the time, but they were going to try and outdo each other with their segments on this film. It was kind of an unwritten understanding. In 82, Spielberg was the king of the hill, where the Hollywood sign rested, and Landis wanted to knock him off it. And so on the fourth attempt at writing a script for his portion of the film, and maybe he was using one of those clunky first-generation word processors in his little Hollywood bungalow at a studio somewhere, I don't know. Landis, though, had come up with a story for his segment that he considered spectacular, enough to out Spielberg. And allegedly, those are Landis' own words about his 25-minute segment of the film. He's going to out Spielberg.
That in itself just tells me Spielberg wins. You're using his name as the you know what I mean?
If he's a verb now.
Yeah, I mean, do you hear
it's like Xerox and Google and Band-Aid. I'm Spielberged.
Yeah.
All right. So the Landis segment was the film's opening segment of the Twilight Zone film, and it was titled Time Out. It involved a man named Bill Connor. In the film, he is played by 53-year-old TV and movie actor Vic Morrow, who coincidentally is the estranged father of actress Jennifer Jason Leigh, which I did not know. Morrow had been in the entertainment business for decades, and he had won an Emmy in the 60s for his portrayal of a American soldier in a World War II combat series or World War II drama series titled Combat, which I had never heard of. But I'll bet our parents, Kelly, I bet our parents used to watch that back in the 60s. I've never seen it on syndication. I've never even heard of it. But apparently it was a pretty big show. He won an Emmy for it. Mm-hmm. Never heard of it. We'll talk more about Vic Morrow later. So in Twilight Zone, the movie, Morrow's character was Bill. He was a businessman in a suit, and he was an outspoken bigot who was bitter after being passed over for a promotion at work in favor of one of his Jewish coworkers. Don't worry, I'm not going to say any ethnic slurs. Kelly is already poking
that
at Katie to hit the beat button on my mic, but I promise.
Like an anti-Semite.
That's the character he plays, yes.
Okay, got yeah. it.
And Landis wrote the segment the way that he did because he wanted it to be a morality tale with a little redemption at the end that takes place in the Twilight Zone.
I didn't know if this was like pointed at Spielberg, like you bring no, Jesus no, no, no,
not,
into it. I didn't
not
know.
That explicit. Okay, no, nothing okay. like that. So Bill, the character, the episode opens. Bill is drinking in a bar after work with his friends, and he's irate. He's shouting these prejudiced remarks. He's slurring Jews and blacks and Asians. He's blaming them for America's problems. Sound familiar? Anyway, after ranting some more and declaring himself to be better than those minorities, Bill storms out of the bar, and as the door slams shut behind him, Bill finds himself in Nazi-occupied France during World War II. Bill doesn't understand what's happening, but the audience knows immediately that when that door slammed, Bill Connor found himself in the Twilight Zone. So quickly, a pair of SS officers patrolling the streets grab Bill, begin to interrogate him. They think that he's a Jewish person. So there's a chase through the city that ensues. At one point, Bill climbs out onto the ledge of an apartment building. The SS officers are taking pot shots at him with their pistols. He falls, but instead of landing in the street, he lands on soft grass because now he is in Alabama in the 1950s where KKK members see Bill running through the woods and think he is a black man and decide to lynch him. But Bill somehow breaks free. He dives into a pond and he resurfaces and he is in a jungle in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, being fired at by American soldiers who see him now as a member of the Viet Cong, the enemy. One of the soldiers throws a grenade, and instead of killing him, the explosion launches Bill, miraculously unharmed, right back into occupied France. Remember, we're in the Twilight Zone. So back in the Nazi-occupied French village, Bill is captured by the Nazi officers. He's thrown into a railway car filled with Jewish prisoners, all bound for a concentration camp. There's a crack in the side of the trailer, and Bill gets his arm and part of his head through, and he sees his buddies coming out of the same bar door, and he's yelling at them for help, but they don't hear him or see him or even see the train. They're looking around for Bill. They can't find him, and then the train slowly starts to chug away, fade to black. That's the first segment. Now, that's what moviegoers saw when they went to the theater in the summer of 1983. But it's not the way Landis wrote the segment originally. Is this boring? Should I stop?
No.
Is it okay?
I'm in.
All right. Good deal.
I quit eating my Skittles for this.
So, like I said, it's not the segment the way Landis wanted it to end. Not the way he wrote it. It was filmed in 1982, which is why we're all here today. The character of Bill was supposed to be slightly redeemed in the eyes of the viewing audience, at least, by his visit to the Twilight Zone. He was supposed to learn the error of his bigoted ways and racist thinking before, at the end, he would still be punished by being sent off to... That was the irony and the tragedy, mm-hmm. that he'd learned his lesson, but he still had to pay for his sins. That was the story that Landis wanted to tell. Now, redemption for Bill was supposed to come through his rescue of two young Vietnamese orphans that he found in the village as it was being attacked by American soldiers in the final sequence, and including the hovering, pursuing, rocket-firing U.S. military helicopter. And now you can have your pin back. So the village firefight sequence that was supposed to be, it was supposed to be the eye candy of the film. This was how Landis was going to out Spielberg Spielberg. This was going to be a low-flying helicopter, up-close passes, the wind coming off the rotor blades, close-up shots of Vic Morrow and the kids, obviously themselves out there underneath this helicopter. It was going to be realistic. The Vietnamese village was going to blow sky high. They had mortars and gas bombs everywhere mm-hmm. to make this thing go sky high so that we can out Spielberg Spielberg with this big finale sequence. But because there was a terrible tragedy on the film set that night, out in the middle of the desert, far outside the city of Los Angeles, no one ever saw the ending that John Landis really wanted, and we will tell you the reason why right after these words from our sponsor. Kelly and Katie, let me tell you guys a quick story. Recently, while I was dining at Easy Street, I met a man from Georgia who told me that he and his wife were visiting the Weiss Lake area, planning to relocate here permanently when he retires soon. I told him the first thing that came to my mind, call Greg Oliver at Go Realty. The number is 256-504-3847. Greg is the owner and the broker at Go Realty right here in Cherokee County. If you're thinking of moving here or anywhere in Northeast Alabama or Northwest Georgia, if you're looking for property anywhere in the area, call Greg. He has a full list of waterfront, residential, commercial, farm, and investment properties, and he's ready to help you find exactly what you're looking for. He's got 25 years of experience in the real estate market. Go again and look at that complete list that he currently has for offer. That's Greg Oliver, Weisslake.com. So visit the website or call Greg Oliver at...
What's that number again?
Thanks, guys. 256-504-3847.
Hey, guys. I want to tell you about one of our newest sponsors, and that is Cherokee Family Healthcare. Cherokee Family Healthcare is located right here on Main Street in Center Alabama.
Connie Geimer, who is a nurse practitioner there, is an acute emergency and family specialist, along with Piper Pierce, who's a family and psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. They offer many services at Cherokee Family Healthcare, such as...
They have primary care, mental health, urgent care, can get DOT physicals, they handle weight loss, IV hydration. We all need that from time to time. You can get a same-day appointment, and walk-ins are welcome.
Yeah, so give them a call
at 256-266-1021. And as we move into our holiday season, the Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce wants to remind everyone to shop local.
Cherokee County has some lovely shops that you can patron throughout the holiday season, get any kind of gifts that you need. Scott, what kind of gifts do you need?
I don't really need anything, but there are plenty of things that I want, and you can get a lot of those things right here in Cherokee County. You can get a great meal at one of the many restaurants that is a member of the Chamber of Commerce. It's as simple as filling up your gas station, your gas tank at a local station before you go out of town to do some shopping, if you have to leave town, but we hope you don't. Stay right here in Cherokee County.
Oh, yeah. And my gift that I want you to get me, Scott, you can definitely buy local. So I'll let you know about that later.
Well, you're going to ruin the surprise.
So we want to challenge all of you to make sure to do as much shopping as you can this holiday season right here in Cherokee County.
And if you need more information, visit cherokee-chamber.org.
Guys, we want to let you know that don't forget that Easy Street is now open for lunch 5 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday at 11.
Great lunch menu.
Let's do lunch.
Brand new. We've shared it on our Facebook page, and I know that Shane has also shared it on the Easy Street Facebook page, so it's easy to find the menu, and it's terrific. Everything on it.
Yes. What's your favorite thing, Scott?
I like the hamburger steak with the mashed potatoes. The mashed potatoes are better than I can make, and I make pretty darn good mashed potatoes.
No, they are.
They're terrific.
Katie, what's your favorite? Yeah.
I like, well, you can get a flatbread pizza. I also like just the chicken fingers.
Yeah, chicken fingers are great. Best chicken fingers in town. How about you, Kelly?
I like the rice bowl with the chicken and the vegetables.
It's all
the
good.
Yum yum sauce.
Ooh.
So delicious. You're not going to go wrong. Salad bar's always fresh. Have lunch at Easy Street. You might see us there one day.
Yeah, you never know. 11 to 2 every day is when the menu prices on the lunch menu are.
That sounds right.
That's right. Something like that. Everything that comes out of that swinging door is delicious at Easy Street, we promise.
Yes. Thank you to Easy Street for being our primary sponsor, our main sponsor. Yeah.
Thanks, Shane. Go eat lunch.
Yes.
Yes.
Come see us.
Thank you to all of our sponsors. All right, Scott, where are we? Are we in a helicopter yet?
All right, look, first, we've been over this. Whoever introduces the show brings us back in after the commercial break, and you guys just screwed it up again.
Yeah.
It's the biggest complaint I have about this show.
I do what I want.
I think we used to do it differently until you tried to convince us that it was like, it was same and same.
It's supposed to be same and same.
Why?
I don't know. Continuity? You know what? Why do I even try?
Yeah. You shouldn't.
Back to the story.
Are we in a helicopter?
Not yet.
Okay.
But we're getting there. So just before the break, I laid out the basic look of the final scene for the Landis segment of Twilight Zone, the movie, as he originally intended. The one with the helicopter and the explosions and the children. Hang on to that. So we're going to shoot this big pyrotechnic scene in what is supposed to be this Vietnamese village, which has been built for purposes of the movie, obviously. And it's supposed to be near a river in what is supposed to be Vietnam. So to create that scene out in the wilderness, you go to this place about 30 miles outside of Los Angeles called Indian Dunes. Lots of TV shows and films have been shot there through the years. You would probably recognize it if you saw it. Possibly. Especially if it was a Western or MacGyver or anything like that. It was a place where you could film at night without the bright lights of Los Angeles showing up in the background, among other things. And it's nice and quiet. It's deserted, so you can blow things up. So the job that night in Indian Dunes is to get the final helicopter scene, get all the big explosions, get the kids running underneath, and then it's the wrap party because it's the last day of shooting for the John Landis segment. It's going to be finished after this. They've been shooting for 2 weeks almost, and this is the last day. Mm-hmm. It's the very last shot of the entire segment. Everything else was already in the can, ready to go. So the entire crew is at Indian Dunes this night. They're going to watch the big finale, and then there's going to be a big party afterwards with food and fire chicks and drugs and hookers and beer, whatever. Just imagine the 80s and a big party.
What are fire chicks?
Did I say fire chicks or fire trucks? A fire chick is a girl who rides on a fire truck.
Oh, okay.
I just made
that
up.
That's a party thing?
It is now.
Oh.
Did I mention balloons? There were going to be balloons.
Oh, great.
Anyway.
Oh, man.
I mean, I love balloons. A party with hookers.
So back
balloons.
In the day, you guys know your Hollywood history. Back in the early 80s, there was widely rumored to be cocaine on a lot of movie sets back in the day.
Back in the day. Okay.
Yeah.
Not now.
So the rumors go. Yeah, not now. Investigators later did find a few beer cans laying around at Indian Dunes that night. But by the time that the scene was cordoned off, and the cops started asking questions, most everyone who had been there had mysteriously disappeared into the darkness. Speaking of disappearing into the dark, everything that we're about to tell you about in the next few minutes happened just about 5 months after the drug overdose death of John Belushi out in Beverly Hills. And everyone in Hollywood knew exactly how big of a drug problem John Belushi had. And John Belushi had been the star of John Landis's previous two films, The Blues Brothers and Animal House. It was well known that those two know each other. I'm trying not to say anything directly here, but I think you get the gist of the connection that I'm not so surreptitiously trying to make. So early in the morning, on July the 23rd, 1982, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. There are dozens and dozens of people out in the middle of the desert. There are sound engineers, cameramen, stunt coordinators, explosives experts, firemen, and all the rest of the crew, and veteran actor Vic Morrow, and two young child actors on their very first movie set, and director John Landis. They're all out there in the desert together. Now, one of those two rookie actors on the set that night was a little boy named Micah Lee. He was 7 years old. Renee Chin was the little girl's name. She was 6. So you had a boy and a girl who were movie extras. First time they've ever been on a movie set. They are the two little Vietnamese orphans that Vic Morrow is going to hold under his arms as he runs across this knee-deep river in the final scene as the helicopter chases him.
I don't like where this is going.
Mm-mm. You're going to hate it even more in a minute. Oh, and it turns out that those two children were there illegally.
Ugh.
California employment law at the time forbade young children from being on a movie set after 8:30 at night.
The time of the night, I was about to say, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In addition, hiring minors always required special permits, and nobody at Warner Brothers had bothered to legally obtain the necessary paperwork for those kids to be there.
Well, the reason for those permits is to ensure safety.
But yes.
Hollywood hasn't cared about the safety of child actors ever.
Yeah, true. Mm-hmm. So apparently everything about getting the kids out to the set that night was, it was arranged via handshake agreement with Renee Chen's uncle. He acted as a representative for the families. He accepted a cash payment on their behalf, mm-hmm. and there was no formal contract. There was no insurance. We all see where this is going.
Yep. I bet that cash payment was pretty low, too.
It was $1,000 a piece for two nights of filming, $500 a night for two nights. So Landis and his production team have broken the rules and snuck the kids out there. They've paid them under the table. And everyone went to all of this trouble for one reason, because Landis did not want stuntmen or dolls in his final shot. He wanted the audiences to see Vic Morrow's face under that helicopter. He wanted to see live children writhing in his arms as they ran from those explosions. Landis wanted the scene to look as real as possible. Great lengths had been gone to in order to keep the kids a secret that night. Secret notes were passed around among studio personnel. Keep quiet about the kids. If anybody starts asking questions, come tell me so we can hide them, because they're not supposed to be out here. The night of the shoot, crew members were specifically told not to mention the kids on their walkie-talkies, lest somebody who is not involved in the plot to keep them hidden over here and them have some splaining to do.
Mm-hmm.
They were to be hidden until it came time to shoot the final scene. It was day number 13 of the shooting schedule for the Landis segment of Twilight Zone, the movie. So the scene as Landis had envisioned it in the final draft of his script called for Morrow's character to carry the two children out of the village and across a knee-deep river while they were being pursued by the soldiers and the helicopter. The helicopter pilot, who was an experienced Air Force veteran who had actually flown Huey helicopters in Vietnam, had stationed the helicopter 25 feet from the ground, hovering near one of the little lean-to wooden sheds that was part of the makeshift Vietnamese village. The helicopter was supposed to buzz around over the heads of Vic and the kids, while it was made to look like rockets were launched from the helicopter and go off in the village, which causes it to erupt into flames all around Vic and the kids. At this point, Vic picks up the two kids, one under each arm, and he's supposed to race across the river and carry the kids to safety on the other side, end scene. And then there's going to be a scene where as soon as he gets into the safely in a cabin in the village, in a shed, an arm is going to reach through the door and grab him and jerk him back into Nazi-occupied France, and the movie's going to end the way that I described it. But he's supposed to be a little bit redeemed by the fact that he saved these two kids before he met his fate.
Mm-hmm.
That was the way that John Landis wanted the scene to appear in the film. Now, a lot of those sheds and lean-tos in the little village were loaded with explosives. They are called mortars, and they send gasoline fireballs into the sky as high as 100 feet. I read one account of the story that said that several junior executives back at Warner Brothers, they read this final draft of the script, and when they saw that it called for a combination of three things, they started to panic. And those three things were helicopters, explosions, and children.
That's not a good combo.
That's three strikes.
Yeah, checks out.
To anybody who writes checks to make a movie, they're thinking, we have a potential problem right here where all these three elements come together at one location.
Yep. And at 2 a.m.?
Yeah, and here we are. And so the filming of the final scene got underway for the final time. In the early morning hours of July the 23rd, 1982, the helicopter swooped back and forth, as had been rehearsed earlier in the evening. The actors hit their marks, they made the right gestures, just as had been rehearsed earlier in the evening. The only thing about the 2 o'clock final shot that was different from the rehearsal earlier in the evening was that on instructions from director John Landis, beneath one of those thatch-roofed huts In the village, a much more powerful explosive mortar had replaced the one that had been used at the rehearsal earlier in the evening.
Why?
Because John Landis has to out Spielberg, and the explosion wasn't big enough. So instead of what was supposed to happen, instead of what happened when the scene had been rehearsed, here's what did happen. The scene was progressing as planned, and all six cameras that were trained on the scene were rolling. John Landis was in hip waders, out of the shot, waving his arms, screaming into a bullhorn, telling the helicopter to get lower, lower, lower. Vic Morrow and the kids were making their way towards the middle of the river, and the helicopter is hovering just over the actors' heads, about 25 feet off the ground. It comes time in the scene for the village to begin exploding in flames and pillars of smoke and fire and debris going everywhere. And the new and more powerful gas-fueled mortar in Thatch Hut number 4 was detonated while the helicopter's tail rotor was still in the air directly over it.
Oh, good Lord.
The metal lid on top of the mortar flew into the air and into the tail rotor of the helicopter, which caused the rotor to fail and detach from the aircraft. And so now we're falling. There are six people in that helicopter, and they're all falling.
Mm.
Because at that point, with the tail rotor missing, a helicopter is a brick with a propeller on top.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's spinning out of control.
Oh, my God.
Headed straight
down. And it's not far from the ground already.
It's 25 feet off the ground. Earlier that night, the helicopter pilot had voiced concerns over his radio about the size and intensity of the flames that were set off at the little village during rehearsal. It would be argued for years whether or not John Landis or anyone else on the film crew even bothered to tell the pilot that the 2 a.m. pyrotechnics were going to be a lot more explosive.
Oh my gosh.
And according to one story that I read, when Landis heard that the helicopter pilot had complained about the explosions during the rehearsal, he said he hasn't seen anything yet.
Oh gosh. Oh,
wow. Remember, Landis wants his explosion, his segment, to be the one that people are talking about when they walk out of the theater. He's got to try and top Jaws. So what he wanted that night was a bigger explosion.
And the helicopter closer, because he keeps telling him to get
That's
lower.
Right. Yeah.
We didn't think that through.
Great question. And so at 2 a.m., the bigger explosion, at 2:20 to be precise, the bigger explosion comes right on time. Not too many seconds after the cameras had started rolling, this huge pyrotechnic blast, fireball, engulfs the helicopter. In total, there were 14 mortars that were being shot from the village, and so the helicopter couldn't even get away. It was just, they were going off everywhere.
Up. Where the helicopter is, up.
Everyone who was there that night said that the entire night, it seemed like there was this sense of foreboding. There was something eerie. They all felt like something bad could happen at any time. Well, that time came at 2:20 a.m.
That's because you're firing things into the air, mm-hmm. and you have a helicopter up there.
That's right. The cameraman...
That's not like a sixth sense. That's a...
Common sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. The cameraman in the helicopter said that it was just at the moment when the explosion started going off that he and the pilot started to receive conflicting instructions over their headsets. The production assistant told him to get out of there immediately. But according to another cameraman, Landis was shouting, "Get lower, get lower, get lower." And he turned to someone and said, "This shot is turning out great, but we're probably going to lose the helicopter."
Who is this man?
And so this soon-to-be-lost helicopter is falling still, straight down, straight into the middle of the river.
Where you have a man holding two children.
As the helicopter lost altitude, also in the middle of the river was Vic Morrow, who had just accidentally dropped Renee into the knee-deep water just as the chopper started towards the ground. Morrow was reaching out to grab her when the helicopter fell on top of him and the two children.
Oh my gosh.
As 100 or so people looked on, including Micah and Renee's parents.
Oh my gosh.
The right skid of the aircraft crushed Renee, who was a few feet from Vic Morrow. Mm. The helicopter then toppled forward on top of Vic and Micah, who were both decapitated by the main rotor blade of the helicopter.
Gosh.
I have seen the photos. Don't.
No.
Don't. No. Don't go look.
Oh, God.
There was a shocked silence for a few seconds until Renee's mother started shrieking as she kneeled over her daughter's lifeless body in the water. The awful moment was captured on film, of course, all six of those cameras, and so you can watch that footage on YouTube today if you like. One viewing was enough for me.
That's wild.
Yeah.
What? Mm-hmm.
Just do it one time and don't ever do it again.
I'm not.
My stomach's upset just thinking about it.
Oh, yeah.
Ugh. According to one account of the story that night, during the catastrophic final shot, the executive producer, a man named Frank Marshall, he was there on behalf of Steven Spielberg, who was not there that night.
I know Frank. Is that Penny Marshall's dad, Frank Marshall?
No, who's that? This is another. He's a very influential producer. Has been with Steven Spielberg his entire career.
Okay, so different.
But it's Gary Marshall.
Gary. Okay.
Penny's father.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, so Frank Marshall is there on behalf of Steven Spielberg. He was so frightened that he dove under a truck. He witnessed the fireballs. He saw the helicopter crash. He saw the disaster and the panic afterwards. One witness said that he had just turned to someone Frank Marshall had right before the crash and said, "What are those kids doing out there? We don't have permits for that."
Mm-hmm. Because you got a sense.
There's just more confirmation that there was a conspiracy to hide the children, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
what?
Don't be too frustrated when we get to that part. So Spielberg's man on the set, he seemed to be the only cool head in the chaos that followed, according to witnesses. Marshall was one of the first to get into the river. And though this act was kept secret throughout the entire 5-year legal case, Marshall carried the lifeless body of 6-year-old Renee Chin to the shore where vain attempts were made to revive the dead girl. And then Marshall ran back to assist John Landis, who was still out in the middle of the river in his waders, running around in circles, screaming, "Oh shit, oh Jesus, oh shit, oh Jesus," slapping the water, the blood-stained water, with his hands. Marshall got Landis calmed down, took him over to the bank, and sat him down on the ground right beside Micah Lee's father. That was the 7-year-old boy.
Yeah, I got it.
One of the last things Vic Morrow said that night, or any time for the rest of his life, was to the hairdresser who fixed him up right before the camera started to roll. He told her that he was nervous about the final scene because it seemed to him that a few people on the set were on drugs that night. He told the hairdresser that every time he walked up to somebody, he looked into their eyes to see if their pupils were dilated, to see if they were on cocaine.
You think to stay awake through the night?
Probably, sure. Yeah, I mean, cocaine was probably already starting
the party.
Yeah, probably that too. I mean, I was only 12 in 82, but I mean, cocaine was just not that big of a deal back then, especially in circles like this. It was like taking a 5-hour energy drink. It just pepped you up. It got you through the night. It was 2:30 in the morning. They'd been there since 7 o'clock that afternoon.
Cocaine is very efficient at that.
Yeah. So not trying to justify the use of illegal drugs, but you just have to know what the time was then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't hard to get. Everybody did it. I mean, rich people did it.
What I was about to say. Yeah. You had to have a lot of money to be able to do that.
Yeah. So as you can probably imagine, in the wake of all of this, it wasn't very long until the legal fur started to fly. And it's going to take 5 years, like I said, for this case to wind its way through the California judicial system. And we'll get to that shortly. But first, guys, this is Hollywood. Business is business. So that movie opened in June of 1983. Come hell or high water, that movie's opening. And it released right on time in the summer of 83. The movie premiered in June of 83 to scathing criticism.
Oh, of course.
The New York Times Review called the film a flabby, many-minded behemoth. Imagine Magazine said it was very unimpressive as modern fantastic cinema from the likes of 4 supposed grandmasters. Roger Ebert barely gave it just a little bit of praise. We all know who Roger Ebert was.
Yeah.
I guess this is a thumb sideways. He said that the movie started slow, almost ground to a halt, and then had a fast comeback, which, by the way, I agree, Kelly, the final segment of the film And I'm not going to spoil it for you.
Okay.
But in one of yours and mine's favorite stars from season 4 of Dexter, John Lithgow is the star of the last segment in Twilight Zone, the movie.
Who directed the last segment?
The last segment was directed by, I think that was George Miller, who did the Mad Max films. Mm-hmm. It's the best one.
Oh, I would have assumed Spielberg would go last.
Nope, Spielberg did the second. Landis was first, and then Spielberg, and then Joe Dante's... some craziness there. And then and then the last one is, it's titled Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. It's a remake of an old black and white TV show episode that starred William Shatner before Star Trek came along.
Okay.
And it's about a man who sees something out on the wing of his jet airliner ripping the engine apart, but nobody else sees it except him.
Ooh.
So he's slowly going crazy in the cabin. Anyway, Lithgow nails it.
I'm sure he does.
You gotta watch
it. He's amazing.
You'll love it.
All right. What did they take? I mean, what is in this segment of the movie that made it to the final cut?
The Landis segment?
Yeah, yeah.
I told you. The first thing I did was tell you how the movie, the mm-hmm. scene actually ran.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things happened. The only thing that didn't make it into the film...
was this final shot.
Was the shot with the helicopter. But it's not going to be the final shot of the film. The final shot of his segment is still going to be him getting hauled away in the railway car.
And that's already been shot.
Everything had been shot except this scene. So that's why they had all the rest that they needed.
Yeah.
And before, on the second draft of the script, they came back to Landis and said, look, everybody's going to hate this Bill character. Make him redeeming in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when Landis had the idea, hey, I can make my character... redeemable, mm-hmm. have him rescue these two kids, and I can spend another $200,000, which is what it cost, and go out and shoot this helicopter scene and really give everybody some eye candy and blow it up and out Spielberg in the process. Two birds, one stone. That was the thought process.
Okay, so how many dead bodies do we have?
Three.
No one in the helicopter died.
Injuries in the helicopter. Those people went to the hospital. Some of them did, but everybody in the helicopter survived the crash.
Wow.
It was only 25 feet straight down.
Yeah, they were so low to the ground.
They were spinning downward.
Mm-hmm.
And if that helicopter landed in almost any other way, it wouldn't have hurt.
No one, Vic, I mean, you just had minor injuries.
It was
the
one spot in the river where the blades
swooped
as the helicopter tipped over.
Gosh.
4 feet in the other direction and they would have been fine.
So now we're in the court case. Is that where we are?
Not yet.
Good Lord.
Not yet. But it sure seems like somebody ought to be held responsible, right? I mean, after all, three people died.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, we're going to get to that eventually, but you're still going to be a little frustrated. Anyway, just to finish up about the movie, the opening weekend, the film made $6 million, which was respectable for the time. It ended up making $42 million on a budget of $10 million. So the movie was technically a financial success,
mm-hmm.
but the plan had been for there to be a new Twilight Zone, the movie, every year for the foreseeable future, with four different directors directing four different segments. It was going to be like a film version of the TV show that was going to come back every year. But that fell apart after all of this happened, mm-hmm. so that's why you've never seen that before. Now, the official National Transportation and Safety Board investigation into the helicopter crash didn't end until October of 1984, a year and a half after the crash. But NTSB investigations notoriously take forever. And all it does is determine why the helicopter crashed. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do guilt or it's trying to figure out what made the helicopter crash. It was May of 1983, just before the premiere, a year later, before any charges were filed. So the story has already come and gone to a lot of the Hollywood industry. The tabloids have moved on to the next thing. John Landis continued to make films after he made The Twilight Zone. Are you guys ready for this? Trading Places, Spies Like Us, Three Amigos, and Coming to America, four of my favorite films of all time, all John Landis films, and all made in between the time of The Twilight Zone helicopter crash and before anybody ever went before a jury to see if anybody was at fault for it.
So he's just... saying it was just a horrible accident.
An industrial accident, unforeseeable. No, you can't assign blame to me criminally because I was not able to foresee that this tragedy could take place.
He goes on to direct all these other movies.
That's right. Wow. Yeah, his legal bill was about $2 million, and he made $2 million for directing Three Amigos, which is Martin Short, Steve Martin, mm-hmm. and Chevy Chase. But his legal bills, it was estimated, were about $1.7 million. So he, Three Amigos paid for John Landis's legal bills. Yeah. Now, according to the accident investigation, Kelly, you were absolutely right earlier. There were two things that caused the plane crash: excessive explosions and the helicopter flying too low. Yeah. That was what the NTSB found. So it was planning more than it was human error that might be considered negligent in any way, unless you consider faulty planning to be negligence, I guess. But that's what a jury is for, right?
I consider this to be gross negligence.
Yes.
Yeah. I would too. And obviously, in my mind, Landis is the responsible party because he's the director on the set. He's in charge.
And he's yelling at the helicopter.
He's the head coach of this football team.
Lower,
it's his
lower,
job.
Lower.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's standing out there too. Maybe that's the only thing keeping people from thinking it was a total accident, because he's out there. It could have fallen on him too.
Yeah, well, we're going to get in front of a jury in a few minutes, but it's going to take us a minute, but we're going to get there.
No, because my mind goes, are people thinking that he wanted this helicopter to crash for like...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he clearly didn't. Or maybe he did to make the bigger boom.
Well, that's going to be somebody's argument.
The
maybe.
Argument with him saying, oh, well, this is going to be a great take, but we'll probably lose the helicopter. Like, if the helicopter crashes, does it work into the storyline? Like, oh, they got away, the helicopter crashed?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, maybe his director's mind is thinking, hey, I can still make this work even if the helicopter crashes.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Don't let me get too far off.
No, it did take a while for the L.A. District Attorney's Office to file any charges in the matter, but finally, Landis and four others were charged with involuntary manslaughter. Among the others was the pilot of the helicopter and the man who was responsible for hitting the buttons that set off the mortar charges in the makeshift village.
Okay, yeah, I would say that, yeah. Mm-hmm. You see that helicopter right there, don't you?
And I think the stunt coordinator and one of the executive producers who was on the scene, those were the five people. It doesn't matter. But there are five people who were indicted.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, one of the more ridiculous stories that I've heard before we get to the trial about John Landis is a story that took place at Vic Morrow's funeral. According to Stephen Chain in his book Fly By Night, which is an exhaustive account of this entire story, Landis pushed himself to the front of the eulogy line so that he could speak. No one outside the Morrow family knew that he wasn't invited to speak, and they just didn't stop him in front of everybody. So in this piercing falsetto voice that Landis has, he repeated the speech that he'd already pre-read to his producer, and his producer said, don't go do that. But Landis did it anyway. He stated how happy Morrow was to be an actor, and he began to mention that just before the final scene, Vic had taken him aside and thanked him for the opportunity to continue his career. Yeah. And then Landis started to say that, hey, movie film is forever and Vic will never die. And the crowd started to shout him down. Enough. Get off the stage. Get out of here. That's something that John Landis did to try and protect his reputation, is force himself up to the podium to speak at Vic Morrow's eulogy.
But really
to defend himself.
He got literally shouted off the stage.
That is correct.
At a funeral.
Yeah. What a guy. Finally.
That's the kind of drama I need at my funeral.
You got it.
Don't tell Scott that, please. Scott, I
there's not much of a chance I'm going to be around to do that.
I really don't think we're going to.
But if it's the other way around, knock yourself out. So finally, there was a high-profile trial that took place. It began in April of 1986, and it lasted 10 months until February of 1987. Landis, by then, all these years later, right, the accident's in June of 82. Mm-hmm. The trial starts in April of 86, so it's been 4 years. But the press is going to have a field day. Landis, he's the prime target because everybody just sees him as conceited and callous and arrogant about the entire thing. He refuses to take any sort of responsibility at all. At least he hasn't in 4 years in any interview at all. And I get it. His lawyer probably says, don't admit fault.
Just shut up.
He's a director in Hollywood, so he's got to do press junkets and promote his new films, all these films I just talked about, and you know he's going to be asked this every single time.
And the people keep getting him to direct movies.
He's a very successful. I mean, did you hear those movies I just rattled off?
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
He made a ton of money on all of those.
Yeah, he did. Wow.
During the trial, It seemed that Landis, perhaps on the advice of his attorneys, displayed this polite smugness, like he appeared unaffected by the deaths that many people considered him to have caused.
Why would an attorney coach him to be that way?
Because you don't want to, if you admit fault, you're...
Just don't say a word.
Don't say anything.
But,
and so it comes off, in John Landis's case, I guess, as polite smugness.
I gotcha. Okay.
The Los Angeles DA, even at one point during the trial, called John Landis a white-collar killer.
Ooh.
The Landis team's defense argument was that, as we discussed earlier, it was an unavoidable industrial accident. The director is in charge, yes, was the defense, but the director also relies on other people who are experts, explosives experts, safety experts, so you can't hold me responsible for every single thing that happens. There is enough culpability in a case like this to go around. This is the defense argument.
But I go back to, you are 100% responsible that the two children were there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
And they would still be alive if you didn't have them there. Mm-hmm. So that is the director's fault.
Wait, now, what death is this trial for?
This is for all three.
Okay,
they've put them all together.
They've put them all together. It's for three counts of...
So that Victor, I could understand. That's an accident.
Yeah.
He's there.
Yeah.
The two children were not supposed to be there.
Well, in pre-file stuff, there was a lot, there were months and months of pre-file things. There was a lawyer change at one point, which added another six-month delay so that the new defense lawyer could get up to speed.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of wrangling about exactly what the charges were going to be. One judge threw out some of the charges against the defendants, but... For whatever reason, the case changed to another judge, and that judge reinstated all of the original charges.
Okay.
It's the book's Fly By Night is exhaustive. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of pages about the trial aspect of the case, which wasn't very interesting, to be honest with you, because it dragged on for 10 months. But it's all there if you want to find out about it. So the defense strategy for all five of these defendants is going to be to stick together. Everybody tells the same story. And remember, we've had 4 years for everybody to get their story together. Because now it's going to be in front of a jury. Yes, there's been a grand jury proceeding. Yes, some people testified at that. But, sorry, their testimony is going to significantly change in a few cases when they get in front of a jury in just a few minutes. Remember Frank Marshall, Steven Spielberg's guy who was on the movie set that night?
Mm-hmm.
He successfully evaded subpoenas. I always say subpoenas. He successfully evaded subpoenas from the district attorney's office for over 4 years and never testified anywhere. Not at a grand jury proceeding, not in a private conference, not at trial. Never had a word to say.
It's almost as if he had someone helping him.
Mm-hmm. Interpol did not locate Frank Marshall, who was in a hotel in Spain at the time working on a Spielberg project and had been for months. They found him just a few days after the trial went to the jury.
Convenient.
But it was too late then. So the five defendants, we got to stick together. We got, what is the old Benjamin Franklin saying? We've all got to hang together or we will certainly all hang separately.
Mm-hmm.
That. Because they were worried that one of them might go and make a secret deal with the district attorney in exchange for immunity for testimony.
I wish someone did.
Yeah. Well, the defense plan, part of the defense plan was to make sure that all five of them had their legal bills paid for. And I told you that Landis paid his own, but I mean, basically he got paid by the studio. They just called it a salary. But the studios and the studio's insurance company stuck together enough to make sure all five defendants had their attorneys paid for this 4 year period. So that they would stick together and tell the same story, because obviously the studio is worried about their liability in a follow-up civil case, which certainly is going to happen.
God, Hollywood.
Yeah. So the defense is going to try and ignore everything. The possibility of drugs or alcohol or none of that. All of that's part of the plan because they think they're going to have to deal with that. So I said that wrong. The one thing that they are not going to have to worry about is the one charge that they were not brought up on, which is having the kids on the set illegally.
Why was that not?
Well, first of all, they're misdemeanors, or they were at the time in California law.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So they dropped those. But that was really the, and so it was, it became safe for all five of the defendants at that point to own up to having the kids on the set illegally because they're not being charged for it. So it was a way for, they hoped, the jury to see that these guys are contrite. They did something that they know was wrong, but it wasn't in order to try and get the kids killed. That was a horrible industrial accident that happened that no one could have foreseen. And you're not punishing us for the kids. So that's why it's safe for us to say, oops, sorry about the kids, because there's not going to be any repercussions from us admitting to that because they're not being tried for that.
Is that justice? In your mind?
I will let the listener decide at the end of today's episode if justice was served in this matter. I mentioned this word earlier, unforeseeability. That was a word that the defense used a lot. That there can't be criminal negligence if the event was unforeseeable.
Got to be Katie. An element of the, I mean, I'm sure if you use one buzzword a lot in a trial, you're trying to prove that the, or you're not, as a defense, you're not supposed to have to try to prove anything, but you're trying to show that the prosecution cannot prove the element of their case.
That's it. And so that became a buzzword. That was just like Katie said, they started using that word all of the time. This was unforeseeable. So we talked about who paid for the attorneys, the studio, and the insurance companies in most cases. Warner Brothers paid a lot of the attorney's fees, the majority of them, because they had $10 million in the film, and they wanted to tamp down negative publicity enough because the indictments came out in May and the movie comes out in June. Mm-hmm. So they don't want anything in the papers about disgruntlement of any kind on the defense team from the Twilight Zone. They want the Twilight Zone opening at the box office to make the news. So they're trying to keep that under wraps. So the studio takes care of a lot of that, a lot of those charges, because ultimately they're defending John Landis. John Landis is their goose. Really, Steven Spielberg. John Landis' friend Steven Spielberg is the one they don't want to get involved in this matter because he was a producer on the film. And if his name gets dragged in, then you really have killed the goose that lays the golden egg. If you can tie him to three deaths.
Yeah, and I don't really think you can tie Spielberg because he wasn't there to the deaths.
Right.
I mean, I understand
but
that.
But somebody's liable to try just because the publicity that you get from, you know, tragedy on the Steven Spielberg movie.
Yeah.
Now, you remember this film coming out?
I remember seeing the film when I was a kid, yes. I would have been 13 in the summer of 83.
Okay, so you wouldn't have been old enough to really have known what was going on in the news.
No,
I was about to ask, do you remember the indictments being newsworthy when the
I don't remember.
Out?
I mean,
but
this would have
been old enough to
well, it would have been 86, 87. I would have been 16, 17 years old, but I'm trying to remember if it was before the debut of Court TV. I think it probably was because this seems like a case that would have been on Court TV all day, every day for 10 months. And I don't remember seeing much about it. You know, later on.
Well, it took it so long because several years have passed. But people don't, you know, when they were seeing this movie in 83, they weren't thinking, oh, here's this actor who was alive when he started working on this movie, but now he's dead.
Yeah.
And we're watching it. Mm-hmm. Was there any awareness of that?
I think there was a general awareness of that.
This guy's now dead.
I think most movie reviews at the time would have said something about this is the movie where tragically Vic Morrow and the two child actors lost their lives, blah, 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 blah. I would think that that was mentioned in most reviews in the movie. So at least you were aware of the fact that, hey, and it may have been the first time in my life I ever realized, wow, these movies are made months. Many months in advance. I mean, I was, you know, 11, 12. It just never occurred to me how far in advance you make these things. And
now,
you know, time passes.
Were the kids in the movie at all?
No.
Okay.
No, that was going to be there. They were in two or three scenes, but obviously none of that made it into the final cut of the film. So just a little bit about the trial itself, and we're not going to get down in the weeds on this, but it was really ridiculous. I mean, the parts of the trial that made it to the papers every day were the fights between the members of the prosecution team. The prosecution team despised each other. There had been a big infight at the district attorney's office over who was going to get to prosecute the case.
Lord.
At one point, the guy who had won the argument He ended up getting into trouble because of something he did outside of business hours, something socially. So he got yanked off the case. And the lady that they put in his place was this little 5-foot-tall, 40-year-old lady who, with a big beehive hairdo, and she dressed very exotically every day. And this trial drags on for 10 months. And you can imagine the impression, perhaps, that a fancy schmancy, smart-talking, smart-alecky little short lady with a beehive hairdo and wonderful clothes has on a jury of 12 regular everyday folks over the course of 10 months, just to plant a little seed. That was one thing that they were worried about. I mean, you guys remember Marcia Clark when the OJ trial, right? Every day the paper became, what is Marcia's haircut today or what is she wearing? That was what was happening with this lady. Her name was De Laurento, I think. That she became part of the story to the detriment of her case. The LA District Attorney's Office really didn't need any bad publicity either, because just a few months before, you guys remember John DeLorean, the guy who built the car that we turned into a time machine in Back to the Future, he had just been arrested and tried for buying cocaine from an FBI undercover agent, and they had video of him doing it. And he still was acquitted by a jury. So another thing the LA DA's office wants is not another fuck up like that one was.
How do you do that? How do you have
evidence? I don't know.
And video.
I don't know.
And the FBI agent entrapment. Saying,
I was about to say, could they get that video into evidence?
It was something to do. I mean, it's a whole big story. It's on my list. The DeLorean thing is on my list. Wow. We need to tell that story sometime.
What the heck?
Because it's right in the middle of he's trying to build his car, and there's labor shortages all over it's a big story. It's a good story. You're not looking like you.
No, I'm just frustrated because I know how this is going to turn out. Yeah. I know. Mm-hmm. In my head, I know what's going to happen. Let's just go ahead and rip the Band-Aid off, Scott. We
can handle it.
Finish the story, but I'm going to be pissed. I can already tell you.
So in addition to the fact that the prosecution all hated each other, the prosecution and the defense, they all hated each other and fought. Okay. They fought in the hallways every day, yelled and screamed over each other's shoulders as one was being interviewed by the local TV reporters. It was a zoo. It was a madhouse. So not surprisingly, the plan to keep everybody on the same page turned out to be a successful strategy. The jury, the media, everybody was just tired of hearing this after 4 years. Because the criminal justice system failed miserably on May the 29th, 1987, when the trial ended. Even though the judge in the case later said that he had every intention of sentencing John Landis to 2 years in state prison when he was found guilty, a jury of his peers, after a 10-month trial, acquitted Landis and the other four defendants on all charges.
We know.
Mm-hmm. There were charges of outright perjury, which lasted for months in the media because of the difference in the stories that were told on the witness stand during the jury trial and the witness statements that were on the record from the grand jury hearings 4 years before.
That's tricky.
A lot of stories changed completely in that 4 year span. Out Spielberg, never heard that phrase. Rap party, drugs, what? No, of course not. Don't be ridiculous. All of that had changed. And it was because everybody was afraid of being blacklisted. Never work in Hollywood again if you said the wrong thing or you didn't back up the John Landis story. That's the rumor. That's what people think. Oh, and the helicopter pilot even said to the press after the trial was over, it took the jury 8 days to reach a not guilty verdict on all counts, by the way. The pilot said to one reporter, I always wondered why Vic didn't just get out of the way when he saw the helicopter coming.
Oh, God.
He said that to the press. He was in trouble for a few days for that.
Let's blame Victor.
Blame the victim.
Obviously Victor and the children's fault. They should have moved.
Yeah, the reporters in the LA area at the time, the ones who covered the case, said that the jurors, the prosecutors, the defendants, even the judge and his own private bailiff had all become starstruck by the Hollywood aspect of the case. Landis had celebrities in and out of the courtroom almost on a daily basis. Then the jury just fawned over all of them. In fact, after the verdict was read, the jury went into the judge's chambers and had a short conference with the judge, and they all asked the judge if they could come back out into the jury area in the courtroom and receive the crowd if anybody wanted to come over and talk to them or shake their hands or meet them after the case was over, hoping that John Landis and his wife would come over. And of course, they were the first two there to hug and kiss and thank.
Oh, they did go speak to the jury.
They did.
Wow.
So actually, the only way that today's true crime story was a true crime at all was in the civil manner of the case, because after a lot of back and forthing, the families of the two children did get about $2 million apiece, and I'm not sure exactly what Vic's family got. I think it was less than that. He probably had better insurance. But much like in the case of the O.J. Simpson case, which we have covered here.
Yep. I was just thinking.
Yeah, there's no criminal liability, only civil liability in this case. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've talked about, or we haven't talked about it, and we won't today, but there's the thing going on now with Alec Baldwin and the film Rust, where the girl was shot on the site set a couple of years ago. I think that movie premieres next month in November at an international film festival somewhere in Poland. So but it's about to come out.
He's been acquitted already.
Mm-hmm. He has, but there's some bet now. The lady who was sentenced to 18 months in jail, the woman who was in charge of the weapon.
Yeah,
The armorer. She's trying to get out because she's saying if Alec Baldwin's argument makes sense to a jury, that you can't hold me responsible if it was unforeseen. Mm-hmm. It's basically the same argument.
Mm-hmm.
Then she wants a new trial because she thinks that she couldn't have foreseen that the gun would malfunction either. But it technically had a real bullet in it. That was her job.
It was her job.
It's not a malfunction. It's a blank or it's not.
Well, I guess it's kind of like Bill Clinton arguing what is. I guess you can argue what a malfunction is.
I can.
I guess you keep trying.
I can argue all of this very clearly. She's responsible for the weapons. And if there's a real bullet in one of them, Alec Baldwin's not responsible for the weapons.
If he's not the one who brought the bullets onto the set.
I don't know why you would ever have real bullets.
Well, and I guess the reason you try to tie Alec Baldwin in is the same reason some folks wanted to tie Steven Spielberg into ours, because he was a producer. He's the big name. Mm-hmm. And he was producing the film. He wrote the screenplay and was producing the film. So
Landis is responsible for this. This is on John Landis. This story today.
I think that part of it is.
I mean, he can't.
I think there's enough to go around.
I don't think John Landis wanted the helicopter to crash and people to die. I don't think he wanted that at all. Mm. So I do think it was an accident in that sense. But I think he was negligent.
Well, but I guess the way the charges were presented, it was all or nothing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so the jury said, sorry, that's not enough for me to send this guy to jail.
I don't think he murdered these people.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that
he was a brash, young, callous. I think he was probably in his late 20s, maybe he crossed his 30s at that time, but he was still a young guy in Hollywood. But, you know, he's known for his brash style and screaming and yelling and jumping up and down and being very animated on the set, just about the way he controlled things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was one of the things they were worried about was a lot of those stories tarnishing the jury.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the five guys again stuck together and kind of minimized what they saw in the moments leading up to. And they all just focused on one story. And when they told it, they all told the same story pretty much. And
that saved everybody. I don't like it. It leaves a terrible taste in your mouth.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily believe he's guilty of murder. So it's kind of a terrible, it leaves you with the same damn feeling the Twilight Zone leaves you
with. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Just this weird hole thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well.
So that's kind of how I feel about it. But
we have visited the Twilight Zone here today.
True Crime
on Easy Street.
Holy moly.
I'll probably never get to go back again, but maybe once is enough. You know, we've got some more Hollywood things that we've talked about doing on the show, and maybe if we get some feedback from people who like this one, there's plenty of great Hollywood true crime stories.
Yeah.
That we can get to.
Oh, yeah, there are.
So how can somebody let us know if they like us?
They can email us at truecrimeoneasystreet@gmail.com.
And say something nice about us on Facebook or whatever your podcast platform of choice is.
Yes.
Shout at us on Facebook. We'll shout right back at you right here at True Crime on Easy Street. Is that it, everybody? Are we done?
We're done.
Good night, everybody.